that type of budget, you should have two riders that are capable of winning. Because Chris, one crash, boom, he's out.
What went wrong last year? I crashed. I fell off my bike.
Halfway through the massage, there's a knock on the door, and it's Ryder, standing there with a cup for me. Made you a juice, Dave.
What's quite worrying is we're still in Derbyshire, and it feels like we've been cycling for a week.
Morale good, though?
No, not really.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And anyone seen Lionel? I think we dropped Lionel on the Cipressa, didn't we?
Where is Lionel? Where are you, Lionel? Where are we, Lionel?
We're on the lower slopes of the Poggio, Daniel. Where are we, Daniel?
We're outside of Boozer in central London, really, isn't it?
It is, really, yeah. So this week we're going to do a truncated podcast because this is the week of the release of our second Friends special, which is a cobbled classic special. You can access that if you're a friend of the Cycling Podcast. Join for £5. If you join at any point, you can access all our Friends special podcasts. So that's a bumper cobbled classic special featuring Tom Boonen, Fabian Cancellara, and some of the young pretenders. But we're going to talk today about Milan Sanremo. We're going to review the race, where sort of the dust has settled now on John Degenkolb's victory. An excellent win for him, a perfectly judged race, I think. Just pipped Alexander Kristoff. Also, I think, eliminated Michael Matthews in the finishing sprint in a very... I don't know if it was deliberate.
Eliminated? That sounds a bit aggressive.
Well, he did kind of take him out of the equation, didn't he? I mean, Matthews had to go the long way around. Degenkolb boxed him in. Alexander Kristoff led it out very early. Degenkolb timed his move perfectly. But Daniel, you always have lots of thoughts on Milan Sanremo. What are your thoughts on the race as a whole?
Well, I think a lot of us feared, having watched the course for many years, so between 1986 essentially and about 2007, wasn't it? We saw the route with no Le Magne and a finish on Via Roma, and we saw a lot of bunch sprints in that time. Those were, of course, what we now refer to as, well, many of those years were sort of EPO years. We unfortunately refer to them as now. And towards the end of that period, it certainly did become very, very predictable. There was no real suspense about what the outcome was going to be. It was always a bunch sprint, which Eric Zabel won repeatedly. The Sunday's race did finish in a sprint of sorts, but it was very atypical sprint in the sense that, okay, we saw a lot of the guys that we were accustomed to seeing in Tour de France bunch sprints in other races, but they were very, very tired. They had no lead outs, and it was really a sort of shootout between strongmen, classics riders, and, you know, a lot of mistakes in the sprint because they obviously weren't very lucid, they were tired, you know, guys launching their sprint too late. I'm thinking particularly of Buhani, Sagan, both sort of launched their sprint with 100 meters to go. Kristoff went too long, he launched his sprint about 250 to go, not really because of poor judgment, but more because he'd run out of men at that point. Luca Paolini had done this gargantuan turn but before the Poggio, really, and he'd kept the pace high
most of the way up the Poggio. I mean, Geraint Thomas, on the way down. Geraint Thomas was away on the Poggio, but he sort of fired a lot of bullets already, and you felt that he was hanging on. The lead was never more than 20 seconds, 25 seconds on the way up there. And Paolini seemed to keep it at, because Kristoff had been in trouble on the Cipressa, like Lionel. He'd been in trouble there. He went off the back, he got back on, and you expected him to pop on the Poggio, but it's not quite as hard, is it, the Poggio? And it's not quite as long, and he was able to survive out there, but it seemed that Paolini judged it just right. He was going fast enough to discourage any attacks, to make sure that Kristoff was comfortable, and to keep Geraint Thomas kind of within reach.
Yeah, we're accustomed to seeing Paolini ride fantastic San Remos. I mean, 2003, when Paolo Bettini, his great friend, won, he really almost single-handedly gave that victory to Bettini. We've seen it on numerous occasions. There's obviously a lot of love for Paolini in the Italian press. I'm just going to read out something from La Gazzetta dello Sport. Friend of the podcast, not Ciro Scognamiglio, but another friend of the podcast, Luca Gialanella, who's the editor of the cycling pages on the Gazzetta dello Sport. He wrote this on Monday morning. Paolini went to fetch Kristoff from the very back of the peloton between the Cipressa and the Poggio, and he pulled for the whole of the Poggio, climb and descent. He had cleverly sprinted over the top of the Poggio to steal another few hundred metres from the attackers, and he dropped the Norwegian off 250 metres from the finish, just like Pataki in 2005. But Kristoff missed a penalty into an empty net. He made the mistake. On the Via Roma, a sprint from that far out and you're made to pay. Luca there is suggesting that Kristoff did make a mistake. I mean, I'm not really sure what he could have done differently. Maybe, you know, when Paolini did pull off with about 250, 300 to go, just sort of bide his time for 50 metres or so, a couple of seconds, and then launch his sprint. He was obviously exposed at that point.
This is why we love Milan San Remo. I mean, I think Mark Cavendish summed it up very well towards the end of last week, where it's a race where every kilometre kind of counts, the energy that you use. Michael Matthews at the Orica Green Edge, a young Australian rider, looked the big danger. But he had gone on the Poggio. He'd followed a little move with Peter Sagan, who made a tentative move on the Poggio. And you just wonder if that perhaps cost him in the finale. Because as you say, Daniel, it's not a conventional sprint. It's a strongman sprint, which does favour the likes of Kristoff. But, you know, he had quite a lot of guys behind him as he led it out at 200, 250 to go.
Yeah, and I think what Degenkolb did expertly on Sunday was stay hidden and sheltered, really, until the Via Roma. We saw giant Alpecin come to the front and do a bit of work and actually do a good job of making the race quite hard along with Cutugia from the Capi, so before the Cipressa. And that was really crucial because so many times in the past we've seen big bunches come in to Via Roma and then recriminations afterwards about teams went to the front too late, they started to amp up the speed too late, make the race hard too late. But on Sunday, actually, from the Capi and Sky were very active at that point, the race became very, very difficult. So Giant really did their work at that point, and then it was just left to Tom Dumoulin on the descent off the Poggio and on the, well, also on the climb of the Poggio to sort of just chaperone Degenkolb into a position where, and you know, he was probably the strongest rider at that point.
We were all waiting, I think, on the Poggio for the attacks to come. I mentioned that Paolini was setting a pace that was hard enough, fast enough, but it can't have been that fast because Kristoff was sitting behind him fairly comfortably. And you thought, this is the most... Kristoff, at that point, you would have said, was the big favourite. If you're Peter Sagan or even Philippe Gilbert, Greg Van Avermaet, you're thinking, this is when we have to get rid of Kristoff. Why were there no attacks on the Poggio, apart from Sagan's little effort?
I think it's a good question. I mean, a guy like Sagan was obviously pretty confident in a sprint, was probably hedging his bets slightly, probably thought that he could win in two different ways. He could either win with an attack or win in a sprint, so he didn't really fully commit to the attack. I mean, I think we've just become, or over many years, we became used to those huge attacks on the Poggio. And again, you know, I talked about the sort of EPO years, the 90s, the early part of the noughties, and that was really
appropriately named noughties.
Yeah, the very, very noughties. That became a sort of recurring motif of San Remo, the huge attack. You know, we saw Ricardo, I remember in 2007 with Philippe Gilbert, an enormous attack. And still didn't win, but there are still a lot of commentators and even fans who get quite disappointed when that we don't see that anymore. I'm just going to read another little snippet from the Italian press's Pier Augusto Staggi from Il Giornale. He said, "A San Remo without any pathos. One of the most banal, boring and predictable of the last few years. It goes without saying, we still got our annual adrenaline shot, but not like on other occasions. Very little happened, either on the Capi or the Cipressa." Now, I think that's pretty harsh.
Yeah, I think it was... The great thing about Milan San Remo, when we spoke about it a bit in last week's podcast, is that sense of building anticipation. And it's almost that sense of anticipation that is more important than the climax itself, if you like. You know, even if nothing's happening, there's still a sense of anticipation. There's still a sense that every pedal stroke is important.
And there is so much happening. I mean, we saw the camera on Sunday pan back to Mark Cavendish at the top of the Cipressa. And, of course, when Cav won San Remo 2009, those were the decisive moments of his San Remo, really. That the last kilometre, 2 kilometres of the Cipressa, when he was slowly making ground on the likes of Tom Boonen and dropping them. And on Sunday, we saw him in a very good position, what seemed to be a very good position. Little did we know that he was about to have a mechanical problem. His chain was about to drop. That really scuppered his chances. I mean, again, another slightly disappointing San Remo for Cav. Another opportunity missed. He'd been ill in the week before. He was still quite confident. You know, I spoke to him on the Tuesday or Wednesday before the race. He was still fairly confident coming out.
Fairly confident, Daniel. You showed me a text message.
September last year. He was very confident in September last year. He'd come back from a trip to South Africa. A sponsor of the Etics Quickstep team had requested his presence at a race in South Africa the week before.
It was no less than Mr. Bacala, was it not?
I think it was, yeah. And Mark had fulfilled his duty to appear in that race. I don't think he was thrilled about it. I think he felt that he suffered from jet lag and got slightly ill on the way back.
It's not much jet lag, South Africa, is there? That's the same time zone, more or less.
Well, you know, how many hours in a plane? 10, 12 hours in a plane. And then to compound that, he had the mechanical problem, which is the second time this year he's had the same mechanical problem, which and the chain has fallen on the right side of the big ring on his chain set. And I know that Etics are looking hard into what's causing this problem. They're on Shimano gears this year, but they've got an FSA.
Because he's looking for an even bigger ring.
And they've got an FSA chain set, and there are some compatibility issues there. So, altogether, not a great day for Cav.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
So thank you once again to our sponsors, Van Dessel Cycles and British Eurosport. It's thanks to them that this podcast is coming to you for free. A reminder that if you want to listen to our friend special, you can go on thecyclingpodcast.com, become a friend of the Cycling Podcast for £5, and access all our friends' specials. A new one has gone up this week, the Cobble Classics. So Daniel Freeman and I are still talking about Milan-San Remo. Daniel, there were a couple of other talking points after the race. One of them was the presence of UCI bike inspectors who grabbed bikes from riders as they arrived at the finish. The bike test, what do you make of that? This is in response to fears that riders may have motors hidden on their bikes. What's your thought on the presence once again of the UCI inspectors?
Well, the interesting thing about Sunday was that it was UCI inspectors in conjunction with local police. There'd clearly been discussions between them. The reason the police got involved was that they were investigating the possibility of sporting fraud. There's a law in Italy whereby if the result of a sporting competition has been in some way distorted, then the police can get involved. So they were there at the finish, by all accounts, pretty heavy-handed. I spoke to someone who witnessed the inspection, someone from Specialized, and they described it as being like a Stasi operation. At one point, the battery of a Durace gear system dropped out of one of the bikes, and there were joyous scenes. It was the way my contact from Specialized described it. Joyous scenes among the inspectors because they'd thought they'd happened upon Exhibit A, evidence of mechanical doping. That wasn't the case. It was just the battery pack for the gears. But this is a story that...
It was mentioned in the CERC report, this threat to the integrity of bike racing, the other forms of cheating beyond doping and mechanical doping, as we call it, was one of them. You've got quite an interesting theory about the likelihood or otherwise of presence of motors and bikes.
No, I just think that the morality of doping, I think riders have in the past found ways to rationalise it to themselves because they either think that everyone else is doing it or that, you know, it's still their talent, it's still their physiology. Whereas I think that for most of them, it would be difficult to square with their pride, their, as athletes, their self-esteem to, you know, be on a bike that's actually propelling them artificially. I don't know, what do you think, Rich?
The omerta that we often talk about with regard omerta. To doping.
I decried the omerta about the pronunciation of omerta.
The silence that exists around doping. Again, that can be rationalised, understood to some extent. It's still, you know, even if you've got three blood bags in a Grand Tour, there's still like the human effort involved in the performance. And you know, if you were riding a bike race and you were suspicious that one of your competitors had a motor hidden in his bike, that would be something you'd be pretty unhappy about. Riders have seemed to be okay with the fact that other riders are doping, but would a rider be okay with even the suspicion that another rider had an engine hidden in his bike? I just don't see it. It's such a hard sport that would crush you.
Yeah. On the other hand, we've become accustomed to believing there's no smoke without fire, you know, especially in professional cycling, and when these rumours are getting stronger and stronger, and they've been around for quite a long time now, and it's not just the press, not just the usual sort of naysayers who are perpetrating these rumours, it's also some of the riders themselves. So.
Yeah, and you know, there are definitely some fears within the peloton that this is a reality. And in that case, it's good that the UCI are taking the approach that they are, and that the inspectors were there, not just going through the motions of checking bikes, but actually getting them as they came across the line. And that's the obvious time to test these bikes. We should give a plug to our sponsor, British Eurosport, and what's coming up on British Eurosport this week. We've got a tour of Catalonia going on at the moment. We've got the GP E3 at Harrobecca. More than just a controversial poster, it's a big bike race over the cobbles. A good sort of prelude to Tour Flanders in particular, and the Critérium International. And next week, the 3 days of Dépannes, so it's all kicking off.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
It's easy to make fun of, well, Sagan and Tinkoff and the investment that Tinkoff's made, the infamous figure now of 4 million euros, but there are an awful lot of teams and riders on Sunday who are completely invisible. You know, there are teams, Garmin, Cannondale, or Cannondale Garmin, yet to register a World Tour point this year. We didn't see them at all on Sunday. FDJ really struggling at the moment. Thibaut Pinot rode well in Tirreno Adriatico, but Arnaud Démare has really not got going yet this year. So I don't think it's a disaster yet for Sagan. I mean, Sagan's real problem is that the so many riders in his mould have emerged in the last 3 or 4 years. You know, you think back to when Cavendish won Milan-San Remo in 2009. There really weren't that many riders of that ilk, guys who could climb as well as someone like Sagan or Degenkolb and could also sprint. But now there's a whole glut of riders like that. Matthews, Degenkolb, Sagan.
Degenkolb, he doesn't look particularly young, but he's only 26. He does look like Zabel, doesn't he, the way he rides. He's a very similar rider in that he doesn't perhaps have that real pure speed. You know, Zabel went years, very consistent at the Tour, but went years without winning a stage. Won Milan-San Remo numerous times, had that similar nodding head sort of sprinting style. He looks very similar, I think. But Degenkolb's a very versatile rider, will go on to the Cobble Classics and could perform there as well. If you want to hear more about the Cobble Classics, listen to our friend special. Listen also to our friend special to hear a very interesting theory about why Peter Sagan might not be performing or winning as much as he perhaps should.
One interesting collateral effect of Degenkolb's victory on Sunday is something we mentioned before in previous podcasts, his market value and what this might mean for Giant Alpecin. Now, he has got a contract next year with them, but it'd be interesting to know what kind of bonuses are involved and whether it's going to be difficult for them to actually afford to keep Degenkolb. We talked about rumours linking him with Etics Quickstep in the past. We're also
rumours that have emanated purely exclusively from you, Daniel.
Mainly. We're also hearing strong rumours about Mihail Kwiatkowski, the world champion, to Team Sky now. You know, Kwiatkowski leaves Etics. There's obviously some money is freed up. Not that it's a team that really struggles in that department. But certainly Degenkolb now has gone from perhaps a million euro rider to a 2 million a year euro rider.
Does Degenkolb's success put any pressure on Marcel Kittel, who has been under, he won his first race of the year in Australia, the curtain raiser to the Tour Down Under, but he's been suffering from illness, he hasn't won since then, and not many people are really talking about that, but does it put Kittel, his Alpecin giant teammate, under any pressure, do you think?
I think Kittel is benefiting from the amount of attention that other sprinters are garnering. There are an awful lot of sprinters to talk about these days, and there's an awful lot going on in terms of stage races, and you know, we're all preoccupied with the battle between Froome and Quintana and Contador. I think Mark Cavendish is a little bit baffled as to why, you know, there isn't the same amount of sort of scrutiny on Kittel and Kittel's slow start to the season as there was, for instance, on Cavendish in 2010. The question we have to ask really is whether the sort of pressure and the extracurricular sort of activities that are incumbent on a guy who has become as successful as he has have affected his winter and how he's prepared for the season, and is that the reason why he's got ill? I'm sure he would argue that's not the case, but it remains to be seen how quickly he recovers, whether he can get back to sprinting as well as he did last year.
It remains to be seen if, when Kittel does recover his form, whether when he does win a race, he celebrates with a gesture aimed at his critics, as Cavendish did at the, was it Tour de Romandie in 2010. We should wrap it up there, Daniel, but we should hear from Brian Cookson quickly, because we wanted to play this. It was missed out last week's podcast, but we spoke to Brian Cookson mainly for our forthcoming Friends special on the doping situation. The PERC, the podcast, Independent Reform Commission podcast, will be coming your way in a few weeks. But we also asked Brian Cookson about another controversy that's going on at the moment about Lance Armstrong's invitation
the
to join.
The controversial Lance Armstrong, as he likes to be known.
Oh yeah, that was quite good. Yeah, he objected to the disgraced Lance Armstrong, didn't he?
Yeah, he likes to be known as the controversial Lance Armstrong.
So the controversial Lance Armstrong.
Just on the controversial Lance Armstrong, as he will henceforth be known on the cycling podcast. What's your view on what we're about to hear, Rich? I mean, I challenged Cookson on Cookson's comments about Armstrong riding a couple of Tour de France stages ahead of the race with Geoff Thomas, trying to raise money for a cancer charity.
I rolled my eyes when you asked Cookson about this, because I just feel like it's a non... It's only a story if you make it a story. And I think Brian Cookson...
That was almost my point to Cookson.
Yeah, I think Brian Cookson, in my view, made an error by making it a bigger story than it would otherwise have been. He's been invited to ride a couple of days at the Tour de France with Geoff Thomas going the day before the tour. It's clearly on public roads. He can't be stopped. So there's no point in trying to stop him. That's my view. You can have an opinion that he shouldn't do it, but really you only give this story legs if you weigh in with an opinion. So I'm shrugging my shoulders about it and saying it's a charity ride. He's not and cannot be barred from taking part in charity activities. Let him get on with it. That's my view. But anyway, here's Brian Cookson on this thorny subject.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
Geoff Thomas, the former footballer, has announced that he will be riding basically the day before the Tour de France, some of the stages, and he'll be accompanied on at least a couple of days by Lance Armstrong. You've called this disrespectful of Armstrong. You're not in favour of it at all. First of all, why are you making a comment on this? I mean, it's a civil liberty for Armstrong to, you know, to ride on open French roads the day before the Tour de France. If there is anything that a banned athlete can do, surely this is exactly the kind of thing that they should be doing. This is, you know, the only conceivable way for Lance Armstrong to redeem himself is to do something which might raise money for cancer and which might serve the greater good.
The first answer to your question, why am I making comment on that? Because a large number of journalists asked me what I thought about it, and I think it's much better to make comment rather than to say no comment, something like that. I think it's a bad idea. I do think it's disrespectful to the current riders in the peloton. It's disrespectful to the Tour de France and so on. You know, I'm not so sure he would get that good a welcome on the roads of France riding the day before. There's already a lot of people out there on the roads. I'm not so sure that they would be that well inclined towards him anyway. But, you know, this kind of charity argument thing, look, I've got nothing against people raising money for any charity. Of course I don't. But are we saying that raising money for charity argument overrules every other moral and ethical consideration? Well, I think we've seen plenty of dangerous examples of the road that takes you down, if that's the case. So, look, I think it's a bad idea. I'm sure Geoff Thomas means well, but frankly, I think it would be better if Lance didn't do that. And I've asked through the media, I'm asking him not to do it.
Geoff Thomas will surely earn more, will raise more money with Lance Armstrong and riding alongside him than without Lance Armstrong riding?
Well, maybe not. But as I say, I don't think the argument that raising money for charity trumps all the other concerns of ethics and morals and integrity, I don't buy that argument at all. There are plenty of other things that Lance Armstrong could do to raise money for charity. I've got a colleague who's about to do a trek to the North Pole, for instance, will raise a lot of money for charity. Maybe Lance Armstrong could do that.
So that was Brian Cookson on the non-story of Lance Armstrong and the Tour de France.
The controversial Lance Armstrong.
That was Brian Cookson on the controversial Lance Armstrong. This will be the end of this week's podcast. We'll be back next week with a special podcast, details to come in the next few days. It's something a little bit out of the ordinary. All I'll do is hint that it's got something to do with Astana. But this will be us for today. I think, Daniel, we'll wrap it up there. Lots of racing ahead of us. And as I say, Become a friend of the podcast at thiscyclingpodcast.com. Thank you once again to our sponsors, Van Dessel Cycles, British Eurosport. And thank you to our producer and editor, Alex Adey. Lionel will be back next week. And thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.